Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. In case anyone might have missed it, yesterday, July 16th, was the Day of Trinity, the 70th anniversary of the first human-inspired nuclear explosion, which occurred in the desert at Los Alamos, New Mexico. Of course, everyone is aware of the second and third nuclear explosions that shattered the two Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, whose names are forever immortal to human memory. At least until our intemperate species blows Mother Gaia into smithereens, an interesting word meaning absolute devastation. I start today's program with something I wrote and have previously blasted listeners to this program with its continual possibility. My nukemare. One morning I woke up from a dream that the Pacific Northwest had been nuked. By whom was unclear. Not that it mattered. Maybe it was Canada. Maybe nihilists. A possibility of fanatics scared me. I sat up in bed and looked out the window. Everything seemed the same as always. Tall spruce trees in a grove gone riot in chlorophyll and flowers I don't know the names of. Same with birds. I heard a dozen birds I can't name. But Pacific Northwest would be a last shot for anybody launching expensive nuclear missiles. On the other hand, I wondered if a missile was up in the ozone, arcing down to kiss the mouth of the Columbia River. I got up and turned on the radio. I don't have a TV, too addictive and rude. The usual prattle and soft rock and syndipity. For a moment, I was relieved. Then I worried the rock jocks were insulated in their headphones and soundproof studios. My dream might have been a real awakening to a horror instantly occurring. I was still thinking in terms of living for years yet. I wasn't prepared to realize my life had just shortened to maybe only days or minutes if there was a missile with Oregon's address cruising the stratosphere. I had hoped for a long, relatively undisturbed life. My wish was that a nuclear war not occur until after I was dead. I thought humanity should survive and be spared a nuclear war. But my particular concern was that I be spared. After me, the world would have to look after itself. I sat at my kitchen table somewhat numbed and unsure, whole, untouched, on what might very well be a dying planet. Earth, Gaia, Terra Firma, Kadur Haaretz, all the names it's been called since human intrusion upon it. In just an instant, one big rotting fruit. I thought squeamishly of several billion dead human beings, and God knows how many dead dogs, cats, birds, horses, and cows would be killed and rotting by a nuclear war. And that just above sea level. Not a very user-friendly atmosphere, though perhaps insects might survive. I wondered when all of us would start dying. A few days or weeks, unless we were ground zero for a missile. I would probably be sick from radiation very soon, vomiting and evacuating from every orifice. Perhaps most of us crawling into our beds to die. Where else would we go at the end of the world? We all knew it could happen someday, even after the Cold War ended and the doomsday priests proclaimed morning in the nuclear age. But we always hoped someday was someday after tomorrow or next year, that it would never someday be today. We tried to beat time. We raced against the juggernaut of inevitability. Too few voices against so many missiles. So many daddy warbucks making big bucks off their big bangs. We were reasonable, obeyed the law, let the government jail us if we defaced a missile or tried to stop trucks, trains, boats, or airplanes carrying nukes. Our reasonableness just might have doomed us. Our little squeals of terror probably amuse the nuke lords. I thought about that crazy old movie, Dr. Strangelove, especially the whole world erupting into mushroom clouds at the end. The absurdity, the illogic of world suicide. We have all been afraid of what nuclear weapons might do to us, but we made ourselves helpless to stop the madness of making so many of them they are able to blow apart a dozen Earths. Too many of us swallowed the nonsense that God's will determined our future. And in the meantime, we split atoms like peas and built enough missiles to nuke every condo and grass shack on the planet. All those lies about acceptable levels, there aren't any acceptable levels. And all the talk about single sources and specific effects, hardly any mention of the evolutionary damage to the gene pool, or about all the other toxic combinations that bombard our bodies and cells. Industrial pollutants, pesticides, radiation from nuclear power plants, tobacco smoke. I hoped prevailing westerly winds would blow the radiation over the mountains. Of course, what goes around comes right back at us across the Pacific Ocean. But if we were lucky, the radiation might dissipate. After all, the ocean is the world's largest air filter. Maybe storms would blow it south or north of here, anywhere but here, anyone else but me. If we could live long enough, our offspring might tolerate radiation better, like flies and bugs got used to DDT. Slight chance of that, actually. But 1,000,000 to 1 chances might be all any of us have left. It is a good bet that civilization would be over for a while if everybody that's got a nuke used it. Back to savagery. Of course, world suicide, blowing everything we've done back to the Stone Age, is savagery of a monumental form. Everything quickly, or more likely gradually, coming apart and not getting fixed. Pretty soon, nobody remembers how to fix anything or how to build anything, and worse, no new ideas. Maybe we are smarter than that and can rebound quickly what might be lost, like after most wars. But sometimes in history, the light goes out. A nuclear war, even a small one, could put the lights out for a very long time, maybe forever. If radiation didn't get us, we would soon run out of food and uncontaminated water. Most of what we eat here on the coast comes from inland cities by truck, and they would be blasted for sure. Local food and dairy products would not last for long. Pretty soon after a nuke hit Portland or Seattle, city people might scurry for the coast. We would be crowded with strangers, with dwindling cash, idle and hungry without shelter, Raging violent mobs would soon attack locals and clean out their homes and stores. Eventually, we might all degenerate into vicious little groups that attempt to rule with murder and terror and fight like street gangs with other vicious little groups. The same futile pattern of our cycles. Samuel Johnson said nothing so concentrates the mind as knowing you will be hanged in the morning. That's how I felt, wondering if I was only hung over from a bad dream, or if it was real. I remembered when I was a kid, duck and cover, stay away from the windows, teachers used to say, stay under your desks until the all clear signal. Even the bomb was a baby then. We were baby boomers, growing up with the baby bomb. We always knew our future was the mushroom cloud. I looked out the window again. Oregon was still Oregon, unchanged, untouched, as was Astoria. And now, from an editorial in the New York Times. The endless environmental review is failing on all counts. If lawmakers care as much about housing costs, energy prices, climate change, domestic manufacturing, and economic growth as they claim, Congress should take a cue from a big ruling in the Supreme Court's last term. The way things were going, building a highway, or maybe even fixing a street, might have been stopped in court on the grounds that it could encourage the production of more cars running on internal combustion engines and hence contribute to climate change. To the chagrin of some environmental groups, the Supreme Court thankfully curbed the increasingly absurd use of the 1970 National Environmental Protection Act to block all sorts of buildings, including projects crucial to protecting the environment. From here, Congress should ease construction of critical infrastructure even further. The court decided that the U.S. Surface Transportation Board could approve an 88-mile train track, even if it might move crude oil from Utah to refineries on the Gulf Coast. The board did not have to assess the potential future impacts if the new track encouraged more oil drilling on one end and more oil refining on the other. A relatively modest infrastructure project should not be turned into a scapegoat for everything that ensues, from upstream oil drilling to downstream refinery emissions, wrote Justice Brett Kavanaugh for the court. Justice Sonia Sotomayor agreed. The Surface Transportation Board would not be responsible for the harms caused by the oil industry, even though the railway it approved would deliver oil to refineries and spur drilling. And that was Justice Sotomayor. Though the decision might seem narrow, its implication for the future of infrastructure is potentially momentous. It pushes back against demands for increasingly stringent environmental reviews under NEPA, which opponents, not always motivated by environmental concerns, have used to block train tracks, pipelines, transmission lines, hydroelectric dams, and wind farms. The goal of the law is to inform agency decision-making, not to paralyze it, Kavanaugh wrote. Congress did not design NEPA, N-E-P-A, for judges to hamstring new infrastructure and construction projects. The decision frees agencies from having to review all the conceivable direct and indirect environmental consequences of any given project, now and in the distant future, In so doing, it should spur broader reconsideration of how environmental impacts interact with other priorities to better balance societal costs and benefits. That would involve Congress. Court, an EPA review of an infrastructure project is not the best vehicle to decide whether the federal government should help or hinder the development of fossil fuels or renewable energy. Right now, it's too easy for President Donald Trump to suddenly advocate for the welfare of whales off the coast of Massachusetts to stop an offshore wind farm there. It is also suspicious for environmental champions to dismiss the welfare of whales only when it gets in the way of wind energy. Environmental review should come down equally hard on a natural gas pipeline and a high voltage transmission line that cut through the same ecosystem. To draw more sensible lines, Congress should reevaluate which environmental impacts society must tolerate and which it must avoid at all costs, looking at the variety of restrictions it has imposed on development. In the 1970s, a new, and that's in quotes, species of freshwater fish called the snail darter was discovered during NEPA research into the building of the Tellico Dam in Tennessee. For the project to be completed, Congress had to exempt it from the Endangered Species Act. It turned out that the fish was not endangered. It was not a separate species. Opponents of the dam discovered, and that's in quotes, it to get the dam stopped. Questions about what should be protected are not going away. A flower called Thiem's buckwheat might stand in the way of a Nevada lithium mine greenlit by the administration. They're turning this flower's only known habitat, condemning it to extinction, said Patrick Donnelly, Great Basin Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, which is suing. Maybe the idea of protecting every ecosystem at any cost should be reconsidered. The flower, which apparently grows only on 10 acres in the proposed mine's footprint, is a close relative of other buckwheats. Is it a distinct species? Perhaps it could be grown elsewhere. Perhaps the battle against climate change, which will require lithium to build lithium iron batteries to power electric vehicles, should take precedent. And that was The Endless Environmental Review is Failing on All Counts. And that was by the editorial board of the New York Times. And now, Donald Trump appears to be leading the most blatant election rigging scheme in American history. In the wake of the New York Times report on the Trump administration's redistricting efforts in Texas, more details have emerged about the attempt to pressure the state's leaders into a potentially unlawful and certainly illiberal mid-decade redraw of its congressional districts in order to shore up the GOP's chances in next year's midterms. Texas government Greg Abbott has instructed his state's Republican-led legislature to craft a redistricting plan this summer in a move that NBC's A's Brown aptly assessed as a mockery of the Voting Rights Act. Trump's civil rights-averse Justice Department has specifically targeted four House seats with sizable Black and Latino populations for redraws, according to the Texas Tribune. And Trump openly has told reporters that he is pushing for a very simple redraw, quote-unquote, so that Republicans pick up 5 seats. He adds that other states could undergo redistricting as well. You will note that this desperate push comes as recent polling shows that Trump's mass deportation agenda has sparked a backlash from Americans. And after his signing of a widely unpopular budget that is primed to strip health care and food benefits from millions of Americans while blowing up the federal deficit to fund tax cuts that will largely favor the rich. In other words, this redistricting push seems like an obvious attempt to insulate Trump and his party. For decades, Texas Republicans have reduced relief programs, cut disaster infrastructure, ignored warnings about disasters, and then exploiting these events to push an agenda that places Texas families in harm's way and manipulates the rules to hold on to power, Texas Democrats said in a statement. Only losers change the rules in the middle of the game, and here they are doing it again, all while making Texas families pay higher taxes, lose their health care, and defund their public schools, quote unquote. Top congressional Democrats, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, have denounced the gerrymandering plan also, and some liberals are calling on Democratic-led states to gerrymander their maps in response should the Texas plan succeed. Indeed, that could be necessary to undercut the GOP's power grab, but that reality also underscores Trump's corrosive power. The openness with which the President of the United States and his allies are seeking to maintain power is clearly chipping away at the nation's democratic foundations. And I have to say that this article was originally published on MSNBC. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. If any American should be tried for treason, it is Donald Trump, whose initial attempt to overthrow the American democracy was based on his character, reflexive compulsion of serial dishonesty and bald-faced lying, plus a nakedly despotic intent to undermine the election he lost by a majority vote of American citizens last time, which ultimately convicted him as a felon for blatantly disavowing the peaceful exchange of power that distinguishes democracy from aristocracy, and will again most likely attempt to choke the throat of democracy like every other sort of bloviated tyrant. He was a lousy president his first term, and has already shown himself even more grotesquely despotic, literally parading his totalitarian insanity down Main Street USA as a birthday gift to himself in tandem with the U.S. Army, which he draft dodged in a time of war, which might well make him a traitor.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.